Don't miss Focus Features' Anemone, starring three-time Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis in his long-awaited return to the big screen. It's the most anticipated performance of the year. Anemone tells the story of two brothers wrestling with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades, featuring Daniel Day-Lewis, Sean Bean, and Samantha Morton. Anemone, directed by Ronan Day-Lewis, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent, only in theaters October 3rd.
Happy Saturday. It's September 27th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in New York City.
I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
Okay, Michael, what's going on the Upper East Side? Yesterday, someone told me it's the new West Village, and every piece of evidence I've seen has supported that thesis.
Okay, give me your evidence.
Well, I mean, I went to Butterfield 94 or whatever that place is called on Madison and 85th, which used to be a Dean and DeLuca when I lived up there. And I mean, there was a line down the block for $7.99 containers of frozen yogurt. It was crazy. And then there were people waiting in line for hot chocolate. I'm like, it's September. It's 80 degrees outside. What is happening here? There are all these kinds of like hype beast little shops. The restaurants actually look kind of good. Is this just like overflow from the West Village? Has it become too overpopulated that they're going to the least cool neighborhood in New York now?
I've heard it's a little overflow from the Village, but also overflow from Brooklyn. Brooklyn is more expensive than the Village in many ways to live. So where can you get an apartment? Upper East Side.
Okay, so that means we've got to go somewhere else. Where's our next neighborhood? Murray Hill?
What?
Hooter City? Like, where shall we go? Like, where can we avoid these people?
Yeah, I don't know. Staten Island?
Now we're talking. Pete Davidson, we're coming for you. All right, well, first, it has been an incredibly bizarre week in the news.
Well, humans as a species may be even older than we thought. The story of human evolution is adding a new chapter following the discovery of a million-year-old skull in China. It suggests that we, Homo sapiens, may have split off as a discrete species around 400,000 years earlier than was previously believed. Perhaps, some scientists posit, we actually originated in Asia rather than Africa.
And as always, airmail is the antidote to it all.
It is. You know, one of the big stories out of Washington this week was Donald Trump endorsing Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s view that alleges there is a link between autism and Tylenol when it's used by mothers in pregnancy. Under Trump, however, these assaults on scientific facts and evidence have grown more common. And our writer, Michael Oreskes, will join us to reveal how top researchers and scientists are putting their own work and sometimes their retirements on hold in order to fight for truth in science. Then, these are indeed strange days where you might be struggling to make sense of them or find words of comfort. And our writer, Gerard de Groot, has a thought. Read Allen Ginsberg's masterpiece, Howl, published 78 years ago. This brilliant, beautiful poem was a powerful rebuke to conformity in 1950s America and those who were suspicious of imagination and artists. And finally, there's a new book out called It Girl by Marissa Meltzer, in which she looks at how the British woman named Jane became the French handbag named Birkin. It's a great little book, and our friend Joan Juliet Buck has read it, and she's going to join us with her thoughts. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Let's start, Michael, with the war on science, which is to say a war completely engineered by Donald Trump. Michael Oreskes, who's the co-author of The Genius of America, How the Constitution Saved Our Country and Why It Can Again, is here to tell us exactly what's going on. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Great to be with you again.
You've got a fantastic and extremely timely story this week, you know, sort of rolling off that news conference at Washington about Tylenol and other things. So take us inside, you know, how we got to this point where top researchers who thought they were going to retire in science are now sort of rolling up their sleeves again.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary situation. And as any number of scientists I've spoken to over the last few weeks will tell you, it's not something they expected. You know, they knew about Trump's anti-science views in one way or another, but the concerted attack on science across a range of issues has really taken people a little bit unprepared. And what's fascinating is that across a range of issues, from climate to vaccines, more generally public health, even economic science, scientists are adopting very much similar strategies to try to push back on the Trump assaults. And the key strategy they've adapted is to try to defend the work of science by reviewing all of the scientific papers in a particular area, whether it's climate or vaccine efficiency and effectiveness, and then republishing that work directly to refute the Trump administration's claims. And we've seen this now on several fronts, importantly, two biggest ones probably being climate science and public health vaccine science.
I'm interesting you say like the way these scientists, you know, we think of the sort of a standard kind of central casting is quiet, timid. I work in a lab. I don't want to be bothered. I want data and not people. And how they're sort of coming together on this. And I was fascinated to, you know, another one, you say republishing these papers is one thing, but tell us about, I'm interested in Megan O'Rourke, who's also a very interesting character in your story this week.
Yeah. So there's various responses scientists had. So Megan O'Rourke was a climate scientist in the Department of Agriculture. As you can imagine, climate change is pretty important to agriculture, and she was pretty committed to her work. But as Trump started to dismantle the climate science function within the United States government, and he's doing that across a range of things, Megan O'Rourke decided that her best response was to quit and run for office. So she is, in fact, now a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Congress in a district, a swing district in New Jersey. Ironically, a district held at the current time by Thomas Kane, who's the son of a former governor of New Jersey, who was actually quite an environmentalist. So times changed, but she was very eloquent about the idea that she needed a way to fight back, and she couldn't do it from within her job. So she's running for office. And she kind of captures what an adventure this is for scientists, because as she herself acknowledged, she wasn't really trained for or prepared for what it meant to be a candidate for office. And at her first appearance, which was covered by Science Magazine, they were so taken by the idea of a scientist running for office. And they pointed out that this was very rare and that there are actually only three science PhDs in Congress right now. So a pretty rare breed, a unicorn. They went to her first campaign event and kind of acknowledged she was not quite ready for primetime, but she says she wants to learn.
You've talked to a lot of scientists, some of who are retired, some of whom are still in government agencies or were in government positions, obviously. You know, you say that a lot of them are adopting what Andrew Dessler, I think, calls a balancing act. So tell us, I mean, it's got to be very pressure-filled for these guys now and women, right?
Yeah. So there's scientists who are in different positions from a political point of view. There are scientists who still are in the government, and that's an extremely difficult and awkward situation, and one we witnessed firsthand this week, this very week, because the researchers at the Food and Drug Administration issued a finding about the risks of Tylenol, and they were very explicit that while there are some studies that suggest some kind of association between a pregnant woman taking Tylenol and later development of autism in their child, there's no finding of an actual causation. There is no finding that says Tylenol causes autism, period. And so they issued a finding simply saying doctors should be cautious and maybe seek to minimize Tylenol in some situations for treating low-grade fevers. Trump, at a news conference, where he went on for an hour about his feelings about autism and his feelings about science, simply blew right past that and said to people, particularly to pregnant women, don't take Tylenol. The scientists, his own scientists, the people who worked for him, didn't say that. They did not say that because the risk of not taking Tylenol, certainly when there's a high fever, could be greater than the risk of taking Tylenol. But science is subtle. Science is nuanced. Donald Trump is not subtle. Donald Trump is not nuanced. So that's the kind of thing you see for people in the government. Then there are people like Dessler. Now, Andrew Dessler is a very important figure. He actually works for Texas A&M University in Texas, a conservative university in a conservative state. He's the head of their extreme weather center. And they have extreme weather in Texas, as the people who lived along the Guadalupe River can testify. Well, Dessler was reading a report from the Trump administration, from the Trump Department of Energy. And this report was carefully customized to debunk the consensus among scientists about the risks of climate change. It basically said, yeah, there's climate warming, the temperature's getting warmer, but carbon in the atmosphere is not the big danger that scientists are making it out to be. That was a direct effort to undermine the main findings of the scientific climate community. And in particular, it was an effort to undermine the finding during the Obama administration that carbon in the atmosphere endangers public health. That word endangers is very important because that's the word in the pollution laws passed by Congress, which give the government the right to regulate pollution. If carbon dioxide is a pollutant, the government can regulate it. Trump is trying to undermine that and undo that so that there's no more regulation on carbon emission. Dessler read this report and thought, we can't let this be. And he gathered all these scientists, more than 80 scientists around the world. And instead of working in the years or even decades that science normally works in, he worked in a few weeks to survey the scientific literature and write a point-by-point refutation of the Trump administration's report. So in other words, he was trying to reassert the validity of the science. And that's the heart of what I think a lot of scientists are trying to do right now, which is reassert the validity of science. And that's an amazing fight and one that I think we will all be affected by.
Michael, do you see any reasons for optimism that that's a fight we might actually be able to win?
Well, first of all, I do think it's somewhat inspiring that this is even going on, right? They're not going quietly into the night. There's plenty of reasons for these scientists to be worried. I mean, personally, I have a certain worry about Andrew Dessler. He works at a university that just fired someone else for going against the Trump administration's gender rules. So I don't know. They're taking a risk, a lot of these scientists, but they're taking a risk to defend the thing they've built their lives around. So for them, it's important.
It is pretty extraordinary. Like, I just want to frame it, to pause, go back to what you said, like, they're reasserting the validity of science. Like, yeah, they're reasserting, like, the Galilean principles. You know, it just is like that we're in this moment. No. You know, the Earth revolves around the sun. No, it doesn't. And that we have to be in a place where you have your facts, you have my facts. And it's just, it's astounding that, it's fantastic they're doing this, but it's also sobering when you realize what they're really having to do is restate long-settled science, centuries-long settled science.
And by the way, there's even an element beyond the question of what science is the settled science, the consensus science right now. In a way, what they're defending is the very idea of a scientific process, that there's a way, it goes back to Galileo, there's a way to know about the world, and we call it science. And frankly, what Trump and the MAGA movement and the Make America Healthy Again movement are challenging are some of these basic principles of science. They're attacking the idea of science, not just some of the findings of science. And that's what's very frightening, but also inspiring about the scientific community kind of recognizing they can't just sit back and allow that to continue.
It's a terrific story, and you're bringing together these extraordinarily brave and intelligent and people fighting for the truth. So it's great to see it.
That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Great. Well, it's good to be with you guys again. And bravo to Airmail for being prepared to publish it. I'm proud to be part of it.
All right. Well, Michael, you know, look, this guy seems like he's got a little smidgen of optimism, maybe. So I think we're going to run with that.
Yeah, run with it. But it's, you know, it just reminds you, like, more things change, the more they stay the same. Reminds me of what our other writer, Jerry DeGroot, was talking about this week with a poem, A Wild Things by Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, this was such a moving and powerful piece of literature published all the way back in 1955. And Jerry DeGroot, who's the Emeritus Professor of Modern History at the University of St. Andrews, is here to make an intriguing parallel with our free speech situation in the U.S. today. Welcome, Jerry.
Hello, yes.
Jerry, would you start us off by just reading the opening lines to Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl?
Oh, gosh. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
So, Jerry, in your view from here this week, you take us back to the unveiling of Allen Ginsberg's now storied poem, Howl, back in 1955. Take us inside the room of the Sixth Gallery in San Francisco.
For a few weeks before then, there were about six beat poets, including Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Neil Cassidy, a few others. And they were all wanting to read their poetry, and they needed a venue, and they found the Sixth Gallery. And it was an old auto repair shop. And in a way, that was suited to what they were doing, because they were a group that was, you know, devoted to chaos and anarchy and dissonance. And so they had this, and they put out leaflets that they had printed around the city that there were going to be these six poets. And they didn't really think, they were worried that no one would arrive. And in fact, when it happened, the place was absolutely packed. It held about 80 people, I think, and there were more than 100 there. And what happened was there was a stage of sorts, not very good lighting, but that's probably suited to what they were trying to do. The podium was an upended fruit crate. Kerouac bought the wine. It was very cheap red wine, and it ran out in the first 5 minutes. because they had more people than they thought. So he passed around a hat and went out and got some more wine. The poet started reading, and Ginsberg came on after the intermission and blew everyone away.
I mean, Jerry, it seems so quaint, you know, the notion of people gathering in the name of poetry and the arts in this way, given the way that we live today. But I mean, what kind of impact did it have in the broader culture at the time?
When I was reading about this, I thought exactly the same thing. You know, it was just so, everything seems so processed today, and it was so raw. And that was absolutely what was suited to what they were trying to do. And the impact, it's hard to say, because it was San Francisco, and San Francisco has always been a little bit weird. And therefore, it was the kind of thing that would happen there. But Jack Kerouac, after Ginsberg finished reading the poem, everybody was stunned. Ginsberg was in tears. Jack Kerouac said, "I think you're going to be famous across San Francisco after this reading." And in fact, within a few years, he was famous, you know, way beyond San Francisco, across the United States and around the world, all because of this poem. Obviously, he had a reputation already, but this was what really was his launch pad. And I think that's what's quite fascinating, because poetry doesn't usually do that kind of thing. Poetry has is more a quiet thing. If people identify themselves as lovers of poetry and they read and perhaps listen to poetry, but the idea of breaking into a wider world was something I think rather strange.
As you write in your column this week, it's such a fascinating moment to look back on Howell, given what we've seen happening in our own contemporary American culture last week with Jimmy Kimmel. How do you think the two relate to one another?
The 1950s were a very conformist time. And to write a poem and to recite a poem that's about drug taking and homosexual sex, those kinds of things, and things which back then were clearly labeled as obscene, was shocking. Because people weren't used to that kind of thing. Nowadays, it's much more common. You can turn on Netflix and you hear the F word all the time. Back then, it was something definitely shocking and perhaps worthy of censorship. But they didn't censor it. And I think that's what's fascinating, because this came not long after the McCarthy hearings. And back then, people did actually still believe in the sanctity of the First Amendment. And though they might complain about the quality of language, the obscenity of language, they weren't ready, I think, to go down that road of actually banning things. Nowadays, you have something quite different, because if you look at what Kimmel said, it's incredibly tame compared to what is in Howell, 7 pages of what was labeled back then obscenity. But nowadays, it's something completely different, because it's not, Kimmel got censored. I mean, it was like they completely disregarded the First Amendment. And what he got censored for was because there's a bully in the White House who didn't like what he was saying. And what Trump has been trying to do, or been doing very successfully, is using the market and economics to pressurize these institutions, ABC in this case, to ban and in effect to censure. So to go around the First Amendment, in fact, completely disregard Kimmel's First Amendment rights to say what he wanted to say.
Jerry, one of the things I think is so fascinating is, as you know, I mean, it was such an overt challenge to the First Amendment back then. People, as you said, believed in the idea of free speech, but it wasn't really being pushed into the public sphere as much with complex and perhaps offensive thoughts. But I love what you know too, that, you know, this poem, Howell, that Ginsberg wrote, is really like we see the seeds of, within those 7 pages lurks, you know, coming down the road, we're going to see Bob Dylan, Malcolm X, Stonewall, the Vietnam War protests. It's all like this becomes the kind of formative text for so much of this explosion of creativity, really.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's about the people that were left aside, the casualties of this conformist society, those who aren't just white bread conformists. And so it does give hints. I mean, if you look at, for instance, Bob Dylan's Chimes of Freedom, it's another poem which says pretty much exactly the same thing, perhaps a little bit more comfortably, easier to read, not as hard on the senses, much more successful in the end as a song than Ginsberg perhaps as a poem. But it took Ginsberg to say all those things and push them out into society, into the atmosphere, to get them to be issues and again, and people talking about them. And Cowell is, even though it's very foreign and it's very alien, it seems at the time, it's a very American poem. It mentions all these wonderful places across America where these beat poets went, like Kerouac went on the road. And yet it juxtaposes those things with all these victims of this society. And so you do get the racial issues. There's hints of young boys having to fight in wars. And it's obviously a poem about homosexuality and about not wanting to stay in the closet anymore. And that's incredible for 1955. Once you get into 1960s, you get Stonewall and stuff, and you get a more openness about being gay. That in the 60s was seen as revolutionary, but to think that Ginsberg did it 10 years earlier, that's astonishing, really.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for this essay and this parallel. It's an incredibly important time to be talking about all of this.
You're very welcome.
That's terrific, Jerry.
Don't miss Focus Features' Anemone, starring three-time Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis in his long-awaited return to the big screen. It's the most anticipated performance of the year. Anemone tells the story of two brothers wrestling with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades, featuring Daniel Day-Lewis, Sean Bean, and Samantha Morton. Anemone, directed by Ronan Day-Lewis, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent, only in theaters October 3rd.
Well, Michael, I don't know about you, but I can never get tired of reading or learning about the one and only Jane Burke and not only her music, but her style and the bag that bears her name. Joan Juliette Buck, who was the editor of French Vogue from 1994 to 2001, as well as an author and an actress, is here to tell us all about it. And don't forget to read Joan's book, The Price of Illusion. It's one of my favorite fashion-y memoirs of all time. Welcome, Joan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So in the issue this week, you review a new biography by Marissa Meltzer about the one and only Jane Burke. And, you know, she's one of those characters who looms so large in the public imagination. But what did you learn about her from reading Meltzer's book?
First of all, Meltzer's book, it's called It Girl, which is a point I make right at the beginning. And, you know, the thing about Jane Burke, and she was an actress, she was a singer, she recorded 20 albums, she was in an enormous amount of movies. Well, I guess she was the emblematic Brit who went to Paris, had sex, and became famous. And her relationship with Serge Gainsbourg, the song they did, Je t'aime moi non plus, all those emblematic things about her. But the thing that has made her most famous in the public imagination is the Birkin bag, which was named after her. When the head of Hermes ran into her on a plane, she carried a basket everywhere. He was appalled. She was carrying a basket. He was the head of Hermes. And he's sitting next to her, and he obviously wants to start, you know, chatting her up. He says, well, what kind of bag would you wear? Would you carry? So she draws a bag. So it's the inception of the bag that made her a global household name, which her work never did.
And how did she feel about that later in her life, that in many ways became her legacy?
One of the things I learned in the book is that, first of all, she was not given a royalty. Dumas from Hermes made this bag for her. It's big, it's bulky, it weighs a ton. And as she said, lovely quote in the book, that it was like carrying a dead donkey because she had so much stuff in it. Dumas did not pay her royalties, but he would send her these bags. He would send them every couple of years. The first one, she'd had it 10 years. She sent it off to be sold for an AIDS charity. And then she kept receiving them and she kept selling them, not selling them for herself, but putting them up to auction for charities. And her profound humanity, I knew her a bit and I knew that she was like that, but finding out that she systematically sent the swag to raise money for charities, pretty good.
Let's go back to her work a little bit because, you know, as Meltzer addresses in the biography and as you get to as well in your review of it, I mean, she did do some fairly amazing things in the world of music and cinema.
There was Je t'aime moi non plus, which introduced her and introduced this very specific way of singing she had, which is very, very high. It's very, very high notes and it's tentative, it's gentle, it's girlish above all, which is, of course, what excites the older Frenchman the most. And she made a huge career with these songs, not just what she did with Gainsbourg, but what she went on doing. And what she played, she was first seen in something before she did a blow up. But in Blow Up, she was one of the two nymphets rolling around on the no-seam paper in the photographer's studio. And she had the long straight hair. She was just, you know, a London dolly bird. But then when she went to France, She did many more films. And what was so interesting was as she aged away from plastic surgery, away from any toxin amendment. She had a gap between her teeth that became somehow more prominent. Her eyes kind of got baggy. She didn't wear makeup. And this whole thing, the way that Gainsbourg made her present herself when she was, you know, his sex partner, his woman, when she first arrived in France, was in men's jeans and big shirts and wife beaters and very androgynous, very much like a 13-year-old boy. As she aged in France in these movies, you see her being more and more daffy and less cooked up for presentation, cooked up for consumption. There's a note of reality that she struck. And there's a movie that Merchant Ivory made called A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries. Kaylee Jones's autobiography. She was the daughter of James Jones, the writer. And in it, she plays this completely daffy British woman called Mrs. Fortescue, who's in the lineage of practically Margaret Rutherford. Now, she was only in her early 50s when she plays, but it's the sort of woman who, you know, she can't really pay the school fees, and she's sort of very artistic and completely impractical. And she does it so beautifully and so believably that she kind of sets a standard for reality.
Joan, you were the editor at French Vogue in the 1990s, from 94 to 2001. And, you know, you have a handle on French style in a way that few do. I mean, how do you measure her legacy in the realm of how not only French women dress, but women around the world?
Really funny. When I got to French Vogue as an American who hadn't had anything really to do with fashion for years, my first issue was going to be La Femme Française. Let's make it the French woman to show them, you know, to put en valeur, to put the spotlight on the French woman. And I said to my French fashion team, I said, who is the emblematic French woman? And they said, Jane Birkin. And I said, nope, be silly. She's British. They said, no, you don't understand. She's bien dans ses baskets, which means she's comfortable in her sneakers. And I said, but sneakers aren't Paris. Oh, yes, sneakers are Paris. And she's comfortable in her jeans. And elle est sans après. Which is, again, après is, you know, what you do to a turkey when you're cooking it for Christmas. So she's not improved. She made no effort to improve herself. And that was her absolute charm. And the legacy goes on today. Jeans, which you could even argue might have, you know, become dormant after her because of the way she dressed and because the way she dressed from the 70s onwards in the jeans and the sneakers and the shirt, that has gone on. That's now 50 years of women wanting to look like that. Nobody else has ever done that without trying, because Chanel was making clothes. She was trying. Jane Birkin wasn't selling anything. She was giving stuff away.
And there's the great irony, because, of course, the Birkin bag has become one of the best-selling, if not the best-selling, and the most expensive-selling bag at all time when it comes up at auction.
Yeah, the hysterically funny story about the Birkin bag is that the first one that she received that put in 10 years of hard work was sent off to raise money for AIDS. And I don't know what it sold for first time, but this is the bag that turned up last July, a couple of months ago, and sold for $10 million at auction in Paris to a Japanese collector, vintage person for whom it's like, you know, it's the Rosetta Stone. It's the Holy Grail. It's the beginning of something. And for her, she did not appear interested in material things. And yet she's come to be associated with the single most expensive material fashion thing ever. That's the irony. And it's also very Oscar Wilde. She came from this British theatrical family. It was army and theatrical. Her mother sang this song that had been written for her called The Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. And her mother sang it while London was being bombed. And famously, she began to sing it and there was the sort of noise of a bomb arriving. And she just carried on singing. So that kind of strong, stalwart, theatrical spine, you know, the show must go on, and what's important is to show up and just do it. And then there was this extraordinary thing where she was so, she wasn't giving in an icky way. She just gave, you know, the idea of these Birkin bags arriving at her house and going out, you know, to raise money for Fukushima. There's a detail in the book. She sends one out to raise money for Fukushima and it raises $163,000. And that's Fukushima. What was that, 2011? And she couldn't believe it. Okay, the $10 million 2 years after her death, God knows what she would have thought. But all this thing of materialism and theater, it's like materialism and theater come together, the importance of being earnest. Jack confesses to the mother of the woman he wants to marry that he was found as a child, as a baby, in Victoria Station in a handbag. And Lady Bracknell says, in a handbag? So you've got this whole thing of one of the most famous lines in British theatre, in a handbag, becomes Jane Birkin's handbag, the most expensive thing ever sold.
Well, Joan, thank you so much. I mean, your insights on this are truly one of a kind, and we so appreciate it. And we loved reading your review of the book, and we can't wait to read the book. It's called It Girl by Marissa Meltzer.
Thank you for having me on.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our weekly culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Ugh, don't you love the way she talks, Michael?
Yeah, I would love to have had dinner with Jane and Joan.
Now we're talking. Dream dinner party.
And you.
And Serge. Don't forget.
And Serge, well.
And Charlotte Gainsbourg and Yvonne Attal while we're at it. Why not?
Just keep adding them. And a lot of Birkin bags. Everyone gets a Birkin bag at the end of the night.
Now that is a dream dinner party. All right. Well, on that note, Michael, you've got something you can recommend to us to pass the time this weekend.
This is all I'm going to say. Slow Horses season 5 is back, right? That's where we're going to be, right? Okay.
Totally. Michael, I have something embarrassing to tell you.
You're only on season 3.
No. Come on. Okay. It's 11 a.m. As we logged on to this podcast, what was I doing?
It's 11 a.m. Ashley was in her bathrobe eating a bowl of popcorn kernels that were half popped.
And why do you think that was?
You were up late binging, let me guess, The Summer I Became Pretty or something like that?
God, you know me too well. Ah, okay. Yes, that is true. And I have no shame about watching The Summer I Turned Pretty. No, I'm in my bathroom because A, I'm jet lagged. I got up at 4 a.m. I ran in Central Park and then I went to the gym and then I took a shower and then I just had to take like a break because I had too much coffee. So yes, it's not as bad as it sounds, dear listeners. You do not need to stage an intervention with me quite yet, but thank God there's some great television happening right now because we have never needed it more. So between The Summer I Turned Pretty, Slow Horses, and our favorite Apple TV show, Du Moment, which is called, what? Platonic. There are a lot of reasons to live. The morning show is not doing it for me this season, but I'm going to keep giving it another go.
I agree. Episode 1, I'll give it another shot, see if they can pull, get some momentum going in 2. But Platonic, I can't love it more. Can't love it more.
Can't love it more. Also, love Rose Byrne, like, passionately. Like, I mean, Bobby Cannavale, you're a lucky man. Like, she is so freaking
crushing hard.
Majorly. Her facial expressions, I mean, she is just so gifted. Like, she's like a half second, you know, she's reacting a half second before you expect her to.
She's got to be one of the best comedic actresses I've seen in a long time.
I mean, I'm a terrible parent, as you know, so I watched Bridesmaids with my children, even though my children are age 10 and 12. I was like, you guys can't live for another day without seeing this film. And there were definitely some parts I fast-forwarded through, so you don't need to call Child Protective Services. But man, that movie is like, it is truly an American comedy classic. And it's largely in large part to Rose Byrne and Melissa McCarthy.
For sure.
Anyway, well, we wish you a wonderful weekend. Michael and I are going to go take out a loan and buy some art. But first, Michael, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Focus Features. Will you please read us out?
Ah. Absolutely. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alessandra Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. And our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. But in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.
Don't miss Focus Features' Anemone, starring three-time Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis in his long-awaited return to the big screen. It's the most anticipated performance of the year. Anemone tells the story of two brothers wrestling with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades, featuring Daniel Day-Lewis, Sean Bean, and Samantha Morton. Anemone, directed by Ronan Day-Lewis, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent, only in theaters October 3rd.